Elsa.
I'm Heather.
We are Beelzebub,
the interracial lesbian couple hanging in there.
And this is
Too Spicy.
So, thank you everyone for joining us for today's Too Spicy. I know, it's been a minute. You've missed us. We've missed you.
Yeah.
But, your favorite interracial lesbian couple has been going through it lately.
Yeah, it's been a lot the last few weeks.
It's been a hectic last few weeks, and so because of that, we have not been able to be our normal cheery selves. I don't know if we're cheery.
We're not necessarily cheery, but critically optimistic.
Critically optimistic.
Maybe we're a little bit of that, I feel like.
Okay, how's this? We won't dance around it. Me and Heather have been experiencing a relationship rough patch.
Yeah.
Maybe if you would
mini meltdown.
Mini meltdown. Maybe if you would have talked to us maybe 2 weeks ago, we would have said it was a breakup.
Yeah, it was feeling like it could be.
It was feeling like it
definitely was. There was a lot of pain, a lot of fighting, and some betrayal stuff that type happened. And it's been really hard on both of us.
Right.
But I think in particular the last week and a half, we've both been able to reflect on our own responsibility and role in the relationship and kind of where we're at and where we were and how we arrived to this meltdown moment.
Yeah, me and Heather have been in relationship counseling since about the top of the year this year.
Like mid-January.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think we've been learning through relationship counseling and through this current rough patch that we're in, through talking to other people, is that relationships are actually a little less to do with the other person and more to do with yourself. So,
yeah, pretty much if you distill all the advice I've gotten in the last few weeks, which has been a lot, it's to work on yourself, that relationships are about yourself and, you know, getting clear on your own needs and then being able to communicate regularly and update.
I was at couples counseling by myself, as Heather was upset with me.
I was too angry and too angry.
But you know, I was in therapy. I was in the counseling session alone, and I was really upset because I went ahead and put the nail in the coffin on this one. And one of the things that's given me really good perspective about the whole thing is that, you know, because I realize I fall into this pattern of blaming everything on myself, beating myself up, taking, you know, disqualifying all of my positives, and it's all my fault, and everything's all me, whatever. So I says, you know, I guess I put the nail in the coffin. And she says, well, even if you did put the nail in the coffin, that suggested a coffin was built. Do you feel like you built the coffin by yourself? And so what that really helped me understand is that there's a lot of, I don't want to say blame, because there's not any blame. But there's
blame.
We both have a lot of issues that I don't think either of us were addressing honestly or properly.
And I mean, I think that in some ways, engagement definitely sent a little bit of a pattern down the road. A little bit of self-sabotage on both of our parts. And
yeah, I think so.
I mean, and I'd heard this from other people years ago, and that sometimes using the word marriage can trigger some serious stuff for folks, and things can kind of get unhinged for a minute, or parts of you that don't normally come out because now the words marriage are around. And I, even knowing that, I was not aware of my own ways that I was acting out. But, you know, it's a growth process. And, like, the hardest part is, you know, knowing that it's about our individual work, but that our individual work has to be done in sight of somebody else.
Right.
And that is a hard pill to swallow and a hard thing to do.
I have to grow and mess up and be ugly all in front of you.
Yep.
And
I do, too. And it is...
It's
kind of horrifying.
Yeah, it's kind of a difficult thing.
And now we're doing it in front of our public. So thank you for watching us.
And I want to thank everyone who's been in touch with us, well wishes, advice, or whatever, meals even. Just, hey, Elsa, did you eat?
Yeah, same here. Meals, eating was very hard for a while for me.
Yeah, there was, you know, I had someone ask me, you know, like, do you really want to be going through this all over Facebook or whatever? And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I have kept myself in the past from doing too much personal vague booking stuff, but I definitely allowed myself permission to just kind of trauma all over Facebook, so I apologize if that was upsetting for anybody, but it was very helpful for me, and it allowed me to reach out and be reminded by you all how much I am valued, and that's been a really important lesson and led to some breakthroughs personally, actually. Yeah. So that's significant.
Friendships are very important in good times and in bad times, because when you feel like you can't depend on your partner, you have a whole network of folks. Mm-hmm. And so I want to thank our network and people who've reached out to me. I thank them for also reaching out to Heather, because, you know, even though we're going through a rough patch, I think we're coming out or coming towards the light at the end of the tunnel, even though we are actually going to split for a time.
Yeah. So we had kind of discussed this idea before our dramatic moment, but we are going to be going separate ways for the summer. I am going to be hunkering down to finish off the work for my first ever solo show in July in Seattle. And Elsa's going to be going off to a friend's place.
I'm just going to disappear into Georgia for a minute. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to disappear.
Be around some babies. Be around some sunshine.
Yeah.
Do some self-care.
Yeah, before me and Heather hit this rough patch, we were already going to spend some time apart. I think maybe that was even our innate system saying, hey, you guys.
Time to reset.
You're smothering.
And we were feeling a little burned out on New York.
I see, one thing I often suggest, and I think I might even said it on this program before, is get away from New York from time to time. Just get out of this city. It's if you're not from here, or fuck it, even if you are from here, you know, you still got to get away and get out.
Yeah, so. It can be a really especially if you're not from here sometimes. Throughout the winter months. I mean, because you just are trapped inside.
It's just a grind. Winter months really feel like a grind. And this winter just seemed like it's never stopped. It still doesn't feel like it's done.
Yeah,
I don't trust it when it's warm. But I don't trust it when it's warm.
Summer in New York is my favorite time. So I am a little sad to be missing
summer in New York is my favorite time. And then I love Pride Month. I'm going to be missing Pride Month here in New York. But we got to go. We got to go.
But what we want to
keep hearing from you guys. Mm-hmm. We appreciate all the reach outs, and people are like, where's Too Spicy? Which,
that was very sweet.
It was very sweet. Thank you, you guys.
We've been missing Too Spicy. I've been missing Too Spicy. Yeah. Let me speak in the eye in that moment.
I've been missing it too. This is one of the things that has really bonded us.
Mm-hmm.
And kept us together, even.
Although the last, 9 months or so have kind of been a pattern of, us not taking care of ourselves. The best part about that period has been Too Spicy. So
yeah.
I'm grateful for this podcast and all our listeners.
And yeah.
So, away from all of the upset, I am very excited to be just hunkering down and working for a month and preparing for this show. And I'm very excited about what I might come up with, how things might shift. I have my last very big white work piece to do, and
you get alone and get into your brain working. And I'm excited to see what comes from it too, and I'm excited to get by myself for a little while. And I think ultimately one thing that has really worked out for us, no matter what we go through, and this is maybe the biggest or thickest or the roughest of rough patches or whatever, mm-hmm. but what we maintain is that we love each other.
We do.
And ultimately, we do want to be married or together or committed. And so we will continue to work through our issues, both individually and together. And also because we want to keep bringing you guys awesome content. I think me and Heather work really well together.
I think so, too.
And there's so much more, so many more things we want to bring you guys.
And it's been sad to... I've been getting snippets of the trash fire happening around in the world, and we haven't been able to keep up.
We have not been able to keep up, but I will
share
this
with you all. But
there's been so much trash fire lately, and mm-hmm. I do want to just touch on maybe what would be the white fuckery of the month.
Mm, yeah, please do. Yeah, we at least have to have that.
We do still need to have it. So hold on, let me introduce this properly. It's okay, the month. White fuckery of the month. Okay, white fuckery of the month is actually all white people right now. White fuckery of the month right now is all white people, and calling 911. You are all on probation at least for the rest of the summer.
Calling 911, please.
At least for the rest of the summer. Okay, I'm just gonna run down when right before we went on break. Our unofficial break, the police were called for two black men in a Starbucks, mm-hmm. sitting in a Starbucks. We had two Native American young men pulled off of their college tour because someone felt, some white woman felt uncomfortable.
They couldn't say what their majors were going to be. What kid?
That's why they're on the tour. Damn it!
That's why they haven't started college yet.
we had a black woman who didn't want to pay for plastic utensils, so the cops were called. And they wrestled her to the ground and exposed her breasts for plastic utensils at a Waffle House. And then most recently, most famously, and there's more, I'm skipping some, I'm missing some, yeah. But most recently, most famously, we have in Oakland, this white woman calls the police on a black family barbecuing in the park because they're using charcoal in a non-charcoal zone.
And that story just...
It's hilarious.
It's hilarious, and it enrages me in so many ways. For those familiar with Oakland, it was near Lake Merritt, and I used to live not too far from Lake Merritt, and I've walked around that lake many times. And then on top of that, you know, Oakland is just black as fuck. Like, that is the history of Oakland. It is black as fuck. And that is its own story of gentrification and what we as white people do when we move into black neighborhoods and policing behavior.
I want to run down the ridiculousness of this woman, though, because she literally goes through three different stages of white woman.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
She does.
When she first approaches the family, it's very confrontational, very angry, shitty even. Mm-hmm. Right. Then, while she's in the middle of this confrontation, another white woman comes up and begins recording her and asking her, "What are you doing? Why are you acting this way? What's going on?" Right? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly her tone is a little more congenial towards this other white woman.
Right. She's trying to create an ally in that moment.
She's trying to, but when she realizes that this woman isn't actually on her side, and she's with I don't know if she's actually with these black people, but she's on their side. She's on their side. And she was like, "Are you really sure this is about the charcoal and not them being black?" And then that's when her mood really changes. Now she's being harassed, even though she came over to the situation.
Yeah,
right. She started this whole situation, but now she's being harassed. Mm-hmm. The police arrive because she's calling the cops this entire time. She's calling the cops. The police arrive, and now full on tears. She is crying and breaking down. I've been harassed, bitch. Please, okay. And which is why this woman is being memed into eternity. Mm-hmm. Okay, ugh, black Twitter at its finest. This woman is shown up in every meme. And I mean, as she should.
Racism is a great reminder that emotions are not reality. If we're ever struggling with that concept, racism is evidence of that. Because we as white people have so many crazy convoluted emotions around people of color, particularly black people, that have no basis in reality. It is all just this weird fantasy stuff in our head. Yeah, and she was a great example of that.
What was her end game? Because here's the thing. White people have to know what they are doing when they call the police. Especially in this day and age.
In general, right? They're looking for a hero, somebody who's going to protect them.
No, what they're looking for is they're looking for this black person to get arrested or die. That's it. Okay? Especially in this day and age. Right? Maybe.
Right. I mean,
maybe
that's the consequence, but what they are thinking, I don't think is necessarily that.
No, they have to. You have to know that when the police show up for a black person, that you are putting their life in danger.
Right. I understand that you have to know that. But mm-hmm.
What do they know?
I don't think that's necessarily the same thing.
I think they know this.
I don't think all of them do.
I think they know what they're doing.
I don't think all of them do. Some of them. I think this woman did. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think a lot of them do, but not all of them. I think that it is like the way that we as white women rely on cops has become so insidious into the way we function and see ourselves in the world that we don't necessarily think through that when I call it, that means there's going to be severe life-threatening consequences for this other person.
Right.
It's like, oh no, I'm seeing something like this isn't by the rules that somebody needs to enforce this. This isn't X, Y, and Z. That's what I think is like the conscious level. I think that...
Right. Let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
When do you think you need to call the cops? In what situation would you, white woman, call the police? Don't even answer that. I'll tell you this situation that I just seen scroll down my timeline, and I wanted to say something, but I almost didn't. I almost did, but I didn't, right? So, my friend posts that if someone from such and such meat company comes to your door to sell you meat, to tell them to go away, to call the police, right? I used to do meat truck, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You have all these meats in a cooler in the back of your truck, and you kind of just go door to door. You go to parking lots and you sell people meat out of the truck, right? So she says she's at her mailbox or something, and some guy pulls up in his truck and is like soliciting her meat and is like flirting with her or whatever. And every time she says no, she doesn't want any, his solicitation, his sales pitch gets a little more sexual or whatever. And like, you know, he offered to get out the truck to show her the meat or whatever. And she was really uncomfortable by it. She says it got sexual or whatever, but you know, ultimately she was fine. But if you see this guy again, call the police. I wanted to be like, don't call the police. Did he hurt you? Like, you know, like, don't call it.
I mean, send his picture around, sure, in your community. If you think that he's actually potentially sexually threatening, I would support that. But, no, I mean, you don't need to call the police on him.
Right. No. Like, I get maybe you were uncomfortable. Maybe he was even being inappropriate or sexual or mm-hmm. whatever. But it's like,
that's a behavior, a rule reinforcement, which I don't agree in calling the cops for that. I mean, I think that if there is a victim, a situation that I encounter where somebody is asking me to call the police,
right.
And it does appear that they are in danger, then I will probably do that because it's being requested of me and given the situation.
Is that a situation you'd call the police?
No. Of course not.
And that's not a situation you would tell other people to call the police about?
No.
I don't think so either. Okay. I wanted to make sure I wasn't tripping. Because I'm like, don't call the cops.
Yeah, I think that white women in particular use cops as such a default action. That is our first resort when anything makes us uncomfortable, is to think, oh, let's call the police. Let's call this enforcement, this patriarchal force that we think is going to be on our side and be a like muscle to protect us. And protect us doesn't necessarily even mean life-threatening. Protect us can just mean...
this made me uncomfortable.
This made me uncomfortable.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's part of the work that I'm trying to do with the Confront White Womanhood is really like work through your emotional response to things.
Are you uncomfortable or are you in danger?
Right. There's a difference there. Like,
that's
there's
what
a difference
I wanted to say.
Like,
I don't think she was in danger.
Somebody who's like homeless on the street than like being actually threatened by that person, by like them coming after you with a knife. Those are two different scenarios.
I'm like,
if they're coming after you with a knife, then sure.
From what she said, it sounded like that was he was saying maybe some inappropriate things, but also, I mean, also just also being meat truck guy. I have been meat truck guy. You do say stuff like "put my meat in your mouth" and like, you know, it's a sales pitch thing.
It's
a sales pitch thing. So I don't
know. Make somebody laugh,
right? You know, silliness
of it.
Yeah, you know. I'm pulling up to your house with a truck full of meat. It is kind of weird. So I'm like, I don't know what level it was. Maybe him actually being inappropriate, her just being uncomfortable with the black guy pulling up in the hood, you know, in her neighborhood with the probably doesn't look like the best truck either, you know. I get it, but I'm like, I want to be like, don't call the cops on him. Like, unless he like got out the truck or tried to touch you or, you know, like, anyway.
Yeah, so we just really need to be trained.
There's
to not
a moratorium
call.
On white people calling the police, okay? Especially if you want a new neighborhood. You don't get to come to a new neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, that's when it becomes most dangerous, I think, is that when you as a white person are in a neighborhood that is actively being gentrified,
right.
So that means that you with privilege are right next to a bunch of people of color who've been in that neighborhood for a long time and probably struggled for a long time. Like, that's when the cops become the most dangerous. That's when they enforce things deadly with highest legal consequences because they are trying to protect you and your money.
Right.
And what you represent for the future of that neighborhood, that city. So that's a key sign that you need to be really cautious about when you call and what the threat actually is and your own personal safety within that.
Because I'm like, look, bro, you can't move to the neighborhood and then be mad at the neighborhood. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, it's too loud? Well, yeah, this is the volume.
Yeah.
This is the volume of this neighborhood and everyone coexists around it.
Right. I mean, I had to go, like, I've begun talking about this a little bit more, but, like, even being a white person who's done anti-racist work for a while, when I first moved to New York, there were several things about my neighborhood that I did feel uncomfortable with. It was a lot of cultural difference. Like, I was in a poor black neighborhood that was very loud, and I wasn't used to that. I wasn't used to seeing so many people on the street. I wasn't used to seeing poverty so up close and personal, or like obvious poverty, in the way that New York does. And, you know, if I had been a different person, then there could have been a whole different set of scenarios that happened.
Right.
But I was also self-aware enough to notice that internal response and move past that.
Right.
And know that that is just a symptom of being raised in a racist society,
yeah.
Being raised in a different environment, whatever.
Just how the neighborhood operates, you moved here.
Right. And so I adjusted to the neighborhood. The
right.
neighborhood didn't have to adjust to me.
It should never. It blows my mind. I mean, and that's the thing with gentrification, right? It's like, it's trying to, like, safe and sanitize it for everybody, you know? You come from your flyover state somewhere else, and you move to New York, and it's like, oh, it's too loud, it's too much. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, no, this is how you came here. And like, I don't need to put, you know, child safety locks on things and dull the corners of shit. Like, this is New York, you know? But
right.
that's for me, is one of my main problems with gentrification. It's not so much that we don't want white people here, is that they get here and then
everything has to change
to suit them, and it's like, I don't know where else that works in the world.
The Jeremiah Moss, who wrote Vanishing New York,
I just read an interview.
Yeah, I just read it. I don't know. The hyperallergic one?
Yeah, I think so.
I really like this interview kind of better than some of the other ones because he specifically called out the aesthetics of gentrification.
Yes.
And the ways in which, in particular, bodegas start changing.
Yes.
And the wood paneling. It's like this visual signal that this is the space for you.
Right.
So you know. So you don't go to other places that look less familiar, and it like makes it a little safer for you.
Right.
And
I'd been noticed that. Mm-hmm. Like, it was when me and Heather lived in Bushwick. We lived in Bushwick. There was a bodega right on the corner. It was nice. It was fancy in that bodega, right? Mm-hmm. And come to find out, the guy owns a bodega on the other side of the block too, right? On the other side. And you look at that bodega and it's like, what the fuck is this bodega? Like, what is this? You can see there's been shit on these shelves that ain't been touched in years, right? That's the type of bodega I'm used to. But your bodega is gentrified. You know you living in a gentrified neighborhood when your bodega get the wood and the chandelier. When your bodega get the wooden shelves and the little tile pieces and the chandelier and the mirrors and stuff, that's the gentrified bodega. And so here's the thing. I was looking at my neighborhood on like Google Earth or something from like a couple years ago and seen a picture of what the old bodega looked like.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, it was a regular old ass bodega. And he just changed it because guess who's in the neighborhood now? The white people here.
I mean, that was one of the big shockers. So I lived in Bed-Stuy for the first couple of years I was in New York, and then moved away to move in with you. And I came back to visit my old roommates, and the bodega that I had shared the block with, which had always been little sketch bodega.
Yeah, they sell drugs in that bodega. Ain't no lights in there.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, nobody had to tell me for me to know that. I just knew. I was like, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it was right next to the liquor store.
Yeah.
And the park. So
they sell drugs in there. Ain't no lights in there.
They did their thing. And
don't ask for no sandwiches.
There was other bodegas around too. But when I came back, that thing had all the wood. It was it had like giant doors. So it was open and airy. There was a like legit deli counter. And
yeah.
Like, oh, okay. I guess we know what happened to this neighborhood now.
Mm-hmm.
They got their bougie coffee shop right before I left.
When the bodega changed its red and yellow sign and the sign green, it'll say organic. Don't be shit in there, organic. Okay,
nope.
Sometimes they just change the awning. Sometimes they really just change the awning to say organic, and they put in like one thing of vegan cheese. But I got this whole bit about how the gentrified buildings look, how the apartments look.
You always knew. I knew this even back in Portland when I was there years ago.
Gentrification got a floor plan.
It was changing because those like sharp, angular, huge window buildings start popping up.
Here in New York, they gray or they black. They, for whatever reason, suddenly niggas got balconies. Like, ain't never been, your balcony was the fire escape. Now there's balconies in the hood. Yeah. And it don't be nothing but nothing you can walk out on and make a, you know, 360 turn and walk back on. But, ooh, you got a balcony. So your builder's got a balcony now, and you know that's the gentrification building. And here's the thing that even blows my mind even further. Some of them shits are so expensive, they sit empty. That even the rich white people can't afford it because they know it's a scam.
Yeah.
They know. Yeah,
that's the most infuriating part of it all, is that they put in these buildings and then they don't fill them. While people go homeless.
Yeah.
And it's just absurd.
Yeah, I have a friend who won the lottery in one of these, you know, mixed income buildings or whatever. So they do a lottery for the cheaper apartments, cheaper units, and she says the top three floors are all like the condos or like the big money apartments or whatever. She say the building been open for a year or whatever, don't nobody live on the top three floors.
Wow.
Like they done through parties and stuff, the building done through parties and stuff in the condos so that people can see them, so people, you know, like, oh, maybe I can't afford to move up in the building or whatever. Right. But they was like, don't nothing happen in the top three floors of the building.
Yeah.
They can't, nobody can afford to live up there. So really, honestly, what's happening is you screwed the poor folk, you screw the black and the brown folk, and then you start screwing the white people, and then everybody's screwed because this is just a big ass empty building now.
Right. No one can live there.
No one lives there now. So.
Yeah.
And you know, it wouldn't be hard to make, because that's the other thing, is like they look so out of place too.
They do.
It wouldn't be hard to make a building that looks like it belongs to the neighborhood and still be nice and new, you know? But they purposely do this so that you know, just the nice building.
Right.
Just the gentrified building.
This is the safe space.
Like you said, it's the safe space. It's all these signifiers or whatever, so.
And I mean, New York's history is to not be a
safe space.
I mean,
you come here and you grit it out.
Space.
Yeah.
It's one where you really have to push yourself.
And you might get robbed or stabbed or raped, okay? That's just the city, all right? You deal with it or you go back to Kansas, bitch. You know, like. But no, really, I actually hope you don't get robbed or raped or stabbed or anything.
Yeah, no, I don't want you guys to.
Crime is on the down.
It is on the down.
Across the country, so. Things aren't as scary as they want you to believe it is.
It really isn't.
So, anyway, you guys, we wanted to come on here and just let you guys know that we're still alive.
We are still alive.
And we're still kicking.
And we still want to do Too Spicy.
And we still want to do Too Spicy.
We still
want
to do Helsa.
We still,
Beelzebub.
We are Helsa Beelzebub. Y'all don't know Helsa. Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. I just realized it. I haven't been using Helsa on here.
We are Beelzebub. But please, and thank you for continuing to donate to our Patreon, and we're going to take, like, the summer off.
But exciting news.
This was we're taking the summer off, but when we come back,
we're going to come back big.
Coming back big.
So, my news is that for the month of July through the first week of August will be my first ever solo show in Seattle, Washington.
Bam! Meow.
So be sure to get on my social media so you can get alerts about that. And I will be doing a Confront White Womanhood workshop alongside the show on July 21st. And the artist talk and reception will be on July 28th. And then the very next day on July 29th, we will be doing our first ever live recording of Too Spicy.
Live Too Spicy!
And that will be our reunion episode. And so epic on so many fronts.
We don't know how that's
going to
be. We don't know how that's going to work. We've never done a live episode before. It'll be two, three months since...
About two and a half months since
this one to the next one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, when Beelzebub goes big, Beelzebub goes way big. So we don't know how it's going to turn out, but show up live and we'll figure it out together, right? We'll all figure it out
together. See this mess in person.
So see the hot mess in person. I love you, Heather.
I love you, Elsa.
I really do. And I have so much fun doing this podcast
with
you.
I do too. I've had a great time.
I've had a great time with you. And really, you guys, we're just taking a time out. We're going to our separate corners. We're going to heal up, let our cut man heal us up, and then we're going to be right back in the middle of the ring for the next round.
Yep.
All right.
Too Spicy part deux.
Part deux. We love each and every one of you guys. Find somebody you don't know and give them a hug.
Ask for consent first, though.